from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson.
Every other president just walks in, it's cool, but we get our first black president, he's got to have like a birth certificate that he shows, they staple to his lapel, and like a signed affidavit from the Hawaii Island saying he was born here, a picture of himself coming out of his mom's womb while she holds up that day's Hawaii Gazette.
That's San Francisco comedian W. Kamau Bell from a performance featured on his CD Face Full of Flour, which is currently on the top 10 iTunes list. He'll join us in the hour ahead to talk about comedy and race. W. Kamau Bell, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The title of W. Kamau Bell's one-person comedy show tells you something. The W. Kamau Bell Curve, ending racism in about an hour. He's a comic with an agenda. He's funny, but he has a point. Jokes are often about race, and so is the conversation he wants us to have, like the story he tells of a guy at a coffee shop who once asked him whether the correct term was crack or crack cocaine, as if he should know. W. Kamau Bell apparently told the first ever joke about Barack Obama on Comedy Central back in 2005, a joke he got wrong, by the way. He's performed all across the country to full houses at comedy festivals in New York and Montreal, and he'll perform here in San Francisco on December 30th and 31st at the Phoenix Theater's New Year's Eve comedy special. And his CD, Face Full of Flour, is currently on the top 10 iTunes Best Comedy list, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. And technically, I didn't get it wrong. I was a Trojan horse. I worked for the Obama campaign way back in 2005, and I was employed to get his name out to the youth of America. I was the first part of the youth movement.
Well, now we have to tell the joke or the line. So this is back in 2005.
Actually, I started doing the joke in 2004. Okay. After the speech where, and it was funny, but because he got a lot of public acclaim at that point, but then he sort of his cue rating went down for a while. So when I did the joke, I'd have to say the Democratic senator from Illinois, Barack Obama.
And the point you were making then, the line that you were putting forward was
that one day we may have a black president, but he'll never be named Barack Obama because that name is too black. And the line was Barack Obama. Who's running for president? Barack Obama. Did you say Black Osama? That's two things I don't like. So that was the joke.
were you really surprised when his campaign evolved the way it did and that he began to get the sort of widespread support that he did?
Yeah, I think as we all were. I don't think I was alone in the surprise. I mean, I don't think anybody thought America was ready for a black president except for him and Michelle and Oprah. So I was totally surprised. I was excited about it. I stopped doing the joke way before I could have. I stopped doing the joke like once he announced. I was like, I can't do this joke in good faith anymore. And I had a lot of friends who were like, you should really be doing that joke. I was like, comedy's one thing, but I got a mom. I have to see black people in the street. So I just, no. So I stopped doing the joke way early. And then the night he won, I got texts from all my comedian friends. Ha ha, you can't use that joke anymore. I was like, it's okay. It's worth losing my closer for the black president.
W. Kamau Bell is our guest this hour. How do you work that into your routine now? I mean, because I've heard you say that you have a sort of rooting interest in how he does and that you're always sort of pulling for the guy. So how do you turn that back into humor?
I mean, I think that's the humor comes from struggle. You know, even when Jerry Seinfeld was upset about losing one sock, he was struggling. You know, like I think that all humor comes from like, and for me, the humor I like the most is the humor that comes from the, you know, pun fully intended, the areas between black and white when you're not so clear on things, when you're sort of like I like Barack a lot, but I'm struggling with like, what are you doing? I had this image, and this is why I talk about my act. I had this image of the first black president, which I think a lot of black people had. And for a second, we thought Barack was going to be that guy. And now we're sort of having to readjust our.
Yeah, describe that story, because you do that in one of your routines, that you actually had a sort of different image in mind, not so much the Tiger Woods sort of image, but a different character altogether.
No, I think I just, you know, I talk about this in my act too, like the idea of that. You know, when I hear the Tea Party say, like, Barack Obama's a leftist militant Muslim, I go, man, I wish. That would be awesome. If America's first black president had been a leftist militant Muslim, that would be a sight to behold. Like some weird combination of the young Malcolm X and the slightly older Malcolm X. You know, all he wore is like baby blue turtlenecks and dashikis and a big nappy afro with a beret tilted off to the side, black leather jacket, black power fist always at the ready. That would be the black president that America would be afraid of, not Barack Obama.
Is there disappointment, do you think?
Is there disappointment? I mean, here's the thing. Certainly, I think many of Barack Obama's supporters are like, this is not exactly what we expected. I say this a lot on stage, and sometimes people don't like it. I go, Barack Obama may be a good president, but he's not a good black president. And there's a distinct difference. And that doesn't mean that I don't support him. I just feel like that if I had like George Bush, for example, was a great president if you were born again Christian from Texas. Like he did exactly what you wanted him to do. Like he spoke, that base never left him, you know, which is why he returned there. You know, and I feel like Barack's base was black people. So we were expecting like the black president, you know.
So how do you fold that into a joke? I mean,
that wasn't hilarious. That is a joke. I close on that. You know, it's difficult because my relationship to Barack changes on a daily basis. Yeah. You know, I'm very aware of the fact, and this is the bigger part of this that is not funny at all, as we talk about comedy. It's hard to talk about comedy and make it funny. That I'm aware of the fact that how I talk about Barack, depending upon the racial makeup of the room, comes off differently. If the room is all black, like I've opened for Dick Gregory a couple times, and his room is a mostly black, older, liberal crowd. If I talk about Barack in that room, they might let me go a little further, but there's a point where they go, stop. Like, you're not allowed to. I had an older black woman at Dick Gregory go, like, basically, like, do you have jokes about white people? I said, yeah. She's like, you should do those instead. Because she was like, that's enough about the black president. But then if I do it in a room that's all white, there's a part of me that feels like, you know, Michael Steele. You know, the one black guy who's like, I don't like these black people either. So it's a really, I'm always thinking about it on my feet. How do I want to do this joke? Do I want to do this joke?
Do you take what's in the news, like this just today, you know, he's signing the tax cut bill that passed Congress late last night, and that lots of people on the left, lots of liberal Democrats in particular, are really unhappy about. So do you take something like that and try to find something within that that then you incorporate into your routine?
I mean, it's funny. A lot of my act starts on Yahoo News' homepage, which is a fun – because – and all I do is just things – I'll click on articles and I'll think about those. And then sometimes I have an idea that turns into a tweet. Which a lot of my joke premises start on Twitter, just because it's a real easy way to like take notes. And if you can distill a joke to 140 characters, like a premise, that means it's probably a pretty good.
Give me an example of something that you would tweet out and then how you would evolve that, I guess, into that would be part of your routine.
Well, actually, there's a track on my first CD that started solely as a tweet. There's a part of it, and I think you said you might play it later, about healthcare.
Okay, why don't you set it up for us, and then we'll listen to that.
I don't know how much you're going to play, but it's just the idea of like when we were in the middle of the healthcare debate, and it was like, well, do we need the public option? It's about the public option.
Oh, actually, the one we have queued up to play is about sort of the Tea Party reaction to that.
So it was the tweet that started that ended up being part of that whole joke was that, you know, right now my public option – I'm laughing because it was such a ridiculous tweet. Right now my public option is Jesus and Benadryl. And the Benadryl's working fine, but the Jesus isn't kicking in like it used to. And so that was a tweet that a lot of people retweeted, and I thought, oh, that's pretty funny. And I started writing a joke, and it turned into this whole bit about the healthcare debate, which is the track you're going
to
play.
All right. Let's listen to a little bit. This is W. Kamau Bell talking about all of the stuff that was going on with the Tea Party protests and how they related to the healthcare debate.
That's what we get to see, exactly how racist this country is these last few months. Like all those town hall meetings, white people showing up off, angry about healthcare. Really? Is that what you're angry about? Healthcare? You seem really angry. Is it about healthcare? It's really about people getting health benefits? It seems mighty angry for something that shouldn't affect you. I'm so angry about healthcare. You are really angry about healthcare. But I feel like there might be something else.
an excerpt from W. Cowbell's CD, Face Full of Flour. You do a good tea party.
I've worked on my tea party impression over the last. I actually had stopped talking about the tea party, and then they forced me to start talking about them again. So I've worked. I'm working on my tea party impression. My family, my dad's family, all lives in Alabama. And there's a lot of tea party down there, and I go down there twice a year. So, you know, I'm embedded with the tea party on occasion.
And how is that joke a way of also getting at something that a lot of your act is about, which is about having this conversation about race, and that race is a subtext to a lot of things. And obviously part of the point of that is that people are really angry about healthcare, but yeah, that's not really what it's about.
Yeah, which as that joke continues down a road, we can't play on public radio. But
that would also be true.
Yeah, so just if people are out there like, well, that seemed like that was really the setup to the rest of the joke, but I understand. But no, because that joke is about how I would watch the news and see them talking about the Tea Party people being angry about health care. And I was like, are we really pretending that that's what they're so vitriolically angry about, that that's where all that vitriol is coming from, is health? And I just was like, and I get so frustrated watching, and this is, you know, the liberal media and the right media, you know, it's like that they would talk about this as if that was what the debate was, that these people are showing up to Tea Party meetings crying about health care. When I'm like, we just elected a black president. That's not – you don't think that has fueling this anger? And yeah. So thankfully as a comedian, which is great, I can sort of just put my opinion forth. And if I write a joke that's funny, then the opinion survives, you know. So I don't have to be held to the standard – well, I don't have to be held to the standard that the media is supposed to be held to.
So what is – you wrote at one point that you're a comedian with an agenda. So I'm curious about that and about the conversation you want us to have about race that you don't think happens enough.
Well, the other thing I wrote that I like is I said I tell jokes, but I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
Because I feel like that really describes what I do. And that describes what a lot of comics that I like. That describes Bill Maher. That describes Bill Hicks. All the Bills. I think Lewis Black probably. Chris Rock. Dave Chappelle. Dave Chappelle kids a little bit. But for me, it comes from like, you know, there's all sorts of comics. I think every comic picks whatever subject they want to talk about. And I don't think anybody's subject is inherently better than anybody else's subject. But for me, when I stand on stage, you're only on stage for at most maybe an hour if you're headlining somewhere. That's not really a big part of it. That's a small part of your life, you know. So why not talk about the things you really care about? So that's for me. And growing up in my household with my mom, single mom, and also seeing my dad every now and again, like race was always a big part of the discussion with my mom. I had one of those houses where we celebrated Kwanzaa, you know, like, you know, which is a black person. I don't know any other black people celebrate Kwanzaa. So,
and you also said that you celebrated without any irony, right?
I mean, yeah,
this was actually a celebration.
Yeah, this was not like the day after Christmas, the Christmas tree instantly became the Kwanzaa bush. And we have Polaroid pictures that say Christmas tree and Kwanzaa bush of the same tree in the same pose. it was black history was not a month in my house. It was all year. Like we really like slide presentations. She'd invite people over. She went to Africa. She'd regularly invite people to talk about Africa. Like it was not a game in my house.
Your mom's a college professor, dad, mm-hmm. businessman. Mm-hmm. You went to Penn for a while, Ivy League school.
I was there long enough to prove that I could do it.
Yeah. Not your normal route to stand up comedy. So, right? Or is
no,
it?
No. I don't think. Harvard's actually a big route to comedy. But as Conan O'Brien has proven. No, it's not. I don't think it is. I don't know that there is a normal route. I think, you know, I think a lot of college. I mean, you know, I think if you meet a room full of comedians, you're going to find that there's people who, like, I know, like, there's a comic named Tim Lee who was a scientist with a PhD who's a comic. And then you know, I know comics who started when they were 17 and never did anything else. So I don't think there is the route to comedy. I just got to Penn, and after about a year and a half, I was like, I don't want to do anything the school is going to want to teach me to do. And so why don't I save my mom's money and get out of here before this debt really accrues? And so I went back to Chicago where I'd gone to high school and then
– Went to school at Second City?
My mom actually enrolled me at Second City. Like I wasn't really – I always knew. I was like, as a kid, I always wanted to be a comic, but you don't know how to start that. And my mom knew Second City was Saturday Night Live, so she enrolled me at Second City and just said, I'm doing this, you know, because I had just dropped out of college and I was doing that depressed thing, and she just enrolled me. And after a brief period at Second City, I always wanted to do stand-up, but I was like, I have to try. I got the courage to do stand-up comedy, but also Second City gave me a base to, like, I'm real improvisational on stage.
What do you want people at your show to do, besides laugh, obviously? What do you want them to come out of that routine talking about that they might not have talked about before?
I just want people to have the conversation. I don't think people have.
What's the conversation?
I want people to have a conversation about race. You know, I think race is number one. But even my stand-up, I talk about a lot of things. For my money, if you walk out disagreeing with me but you're talking to somebody about it, mission accomplished. I get emails from people who say I disagreed with everything you said, and I'm like, great, talk to your friends about it. Like, I just feel like a lot of these conversations have sort of happened in cloisters. Like, you only talk to the people who agree with you. And I feel like the thing that my show does when it works is that friends will have different perspectives. Like we have a thing with my show, the one man show, where if you bring a friend of a different race, you get in 2-for-1. You know, which I've been doing ever since we started. That was the first thing we did with the show. So, which means that the racial makeup of the show is always more racially mixed than your average theater audience, because your average theater audience is a pretty older white audience. So it's always changed, which means that in the room, I will say something and different factions of the room will have completely different reactions to it. And if they see each other having different reactions, they go, wait a minute, he must be making some kind of point. Like, I'm laughing, she's horrified, he's put his head down. You know, like, it's like, but it means that, like, my opinion is not the only opinion, which is my whole thing about that. You don't have to agree with me. Sometimes I've said things that I later go, I don't agree with that thing I said. But you just at least want to be aware that your opinion is not the only one.
I mentioned in the introduction the example that you give or that you use in your routine sometimes of being at a coffee shop and some guy you've never met before turns to you and says, is the correct term, by the way, crack or crack cocaine?
Yes.
Assuming you, of course.
Yeah. Like, well, I mean, you know, I think especially being black in San Francisco, which is like almost an endangered species, like, the city's only 5% black. The country's 12% black. This is the most liberal city in the world. Like, where'd the black people go? And people say Oakland. Well, they're actually leaving Oakland, too. You know, like, I'm pretty regularly, and I think there's other black people out there who can attest to this, too, in situations where you have to answer black questions.
Yeah.
You know, and you're expected to be the spokesperson. And the person asking the question, 9 times out of 10 doesn't mean any harm, but that doesn't mean it's not harmful.
Yeah.
You know, I talk about in my show, like, the levels of racism. Like, we only think of racism as, like a hate crime, or that weird office racism where you say Puerto Rican and you're not supposed to say Puerto Rican, you know. But there's all sorts of levels of, like, things that are perceived as racism. They don't all have to end up with a hate crime, you
or
know?
or like the great hair question.
Yeah. Like, the two things to never ask a black person about their hair, which are totally serious. And I hear white people always go, like, and that's the great thing about the crowd being mixed is that, especially black women, as soon as I say there's two things that I ask a black person about the hair, you hear black women going, and just start shaking the hair. Because I used to have dreadlocks, so I had that thing that black women, a lot of black men don't have that thing where people ask about their hair, but I had dreadlocks, so I got those questions. But black women who have spent a lot of time on their hair get those questions all the time, and they are so keyed in and ready, and I will point them out that, look, these black women know what I'm talking about. And a lot of the people who aren't black women return to look and go, what's about to happen? Like, they don't even know where I'm going until I do it. And then they will realize, oh, I've either asked that, or I've heard that, or I've never heard that, but that's something I should be aware of. So that's one of the best sections of the show. It's the part of the show where I allow myself to get the angriest, and I do that because it's about something that's so small. You know, it'd be real easy for me to get angry about the Tea Party in a real visceral way, but that doesn't surprise anybody. But the bigger slight that I think a lot of people feel in race, and this is black, anybody who's an other, I don't say minority or people of color, I call us obvious ethnics. You know, we're all ethnic, just some of us a little more obvious about it. So any obvious ethnic runs into these things where you have to sort of explain yourself, or how do I say I love you in your language? I don't got to tell you that. You know, like, get Rosetta Stone. You know, how do I want to get a tattoo on my arm in your language? You didn't learn my language and know that the tattoo is right, you know?
So you said there were two things about
so
don't ask about hair, but
two things to never ask a black person about their hair.
Yeah.
That one is, can I touch it? The answer is no. It's always been no. It's always going to be no. Even if we say yes, we mean no. It's just awkward because we're at work and you're our boss and it's a board meeting and everybody's staring and we can't get fired during this economy. And now there's a line forming. So we go, yeah, I guess you can. It feels like a Brillo pad. Good to know that. which I've had all those, does Velcro stick to it? All those sort of weird, like, sometimes is the answer to that question. And the second thing to never ask a black person about their hair is, how do you wash it? And it really, that's a big one. Like every time you hear that, and I, in my routine, I go through this whole thing about like, well, first, here's how every black person down the hair. We go down to the river, we get our grandmama skillet, we dip it in the river, and we get some good old river silt and some cornmeal and a St. John the Conger root and Alex Haley's book Roots and some ginseng root, the new CD from the band The Roots. And we wait for the new moon after the vernal equinox and sing a couple Negro spirituals like Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. And then when it's a bubbling and a boiling, we wait and throw it in the rivers, use Head and Shoulders. How do you wash your hair? How do you sleep at night asking such dumb questions? So I'm restraining myself because it's so early in the morning. But that's like in the show, it becomes this huge, like vein popping out of my head moment that the black people, especially like when they feel very viscerally, and everybody sees them feeling it viscerally, and everybody, it's like a huge, everybody gets it. Like, you know, racism doesn't have to be, I'm not hiring you. There's many, the most difficult levels of racism are things like that.
And do you know when that happens, when people get it?
No. I know when people say they get it. But I mean, regularly after the show, people will do this as a joke. Your show is great. Your show is great. Can I touch your hair? I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. And it's like, but that's not, you've totally missed the point.
Yeah.
And so I feel like I don't think, like people ask this all the time, can comedy change the world? And it's like, I think comedy can point out the problems in the world, but the world has to change itself. You know, I think that's like Bob Dylan. I think Bob Dylan's music pointed out a lot of the problems in the world, but the world has to change itself.
W. Kamau Bell is our guest. He will appear at the cheapest, greatest New Year's Eve comedy show at the Phoenix Theater in downtown San Francisco. Not only on New Year's Eve, but the eve of the eve.
Yeah, the December 30th, New Year's Eve. And it's only $15. It's the cheapest, greatest comedy show you'll ever see in your life. $15. There's no half price tickets. It's $15. There's no gold star events. It's $15. Just go to the show.
I want to ask you about the other side of this, and we'll have to cheat this and come back to it on the other side of our break. But you talked about how people reacted, and people react differently based on race. There's a point in your show where you talk about you're about to get married. This is a year and a half ago before you actually got married.
Yes.
And people applaud. Mm-hmm. And then you say the next line, and you can sort of hear the kind of reaction. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's like this happens and the show is constructed like this totally on purpose. I worked with my director, Martha Reinberg, on the show very hard. And then I took it to L.A. and got a new director, not because Martha was bad, but just because it was Martha's great. And she runs the Solo Performance Workshop, which is my solo performance school. And I got a new director, Paul Stein, who helped me craft the show because it was just a bunch of ideas in my head that were sort of like, blah, and they helped me sort of turn into a show. And so about 90% into the show, after talking about race for an hour, I go, so I'm getting married, people clap, to a white woman. And not all the time, but I'd say 75% of the time, there's some sort of reaction like, from, and actually from the black people, maybe more than the white people, but certainly the white people just, oh, okay. You know, black people like, and I had a woman one time after the show say, when you said that you were the black one, when you said you were married to a white or getting married to a white woman, I was so mad and upset. And then I realized I was with a white guy. It was like, exactly. Like, there's all this stuff in our head.
And real quick, tell the story of the first time you went out on a date with your now wife, the reaction that someone had, a black woman who walked in.
We were in the Mission in San Francisco, went to a taqueria, I think it's at 17th and Mission, splitting a burrito, because that's our role. And this black woman saw us together, and it was our first date. We weren't holding hands or anything. This black woman, and just became like, you could see her get apoplectically angry about the fact that what are these two doing together? And my wife was like, is she mad about the fact we're together? Because my wife doesn't have a lot of experience with this. I was like, yeah, that's what's going on here. And she got so angry that the guy she was with, the black man she was with, they literally couldn't get their burrito and they had to be escorted out of the place.
W. Kamau Bell, our guest. Again, he'll appear at the greatest, cheapest New Year's Eve comedy show at the Phoenix Theater in San Francisco on December 30th and 31st. We'll talk more when we come back after our break. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you have a story you want to share with us about your own experiences with race in San Francisco, you're welcome to do that. Here's the number, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Back with more in just a moment. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest this hour, W. Kamau Bell. He will be performing again New Year's Eve and New Year's Eve of Eve, 30th and 31st, at the Phoenix Theater in downtown San Francisco. We welcome your calls and thoughts and stories to tell at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. Lots of people calling in. We'll get to those in just a moment. But before we do, I want to pick up on one more thing about your experience of dating, now marrying someone who's white. You do a funny thing in one of your routines about
just
how you...
Just in one. Just in one, Dave.
In many. Okay. But in this particular one... Yes. You do something where you talk about what's going to happen when you have kids, mm-hmm. and you're going to sort of – you'll be able to sort of take them off and do mm-hmm. a little bit of the black caucus within the family.
Yeah, I talk about how my wife like said at one point like that when we have kids, our kids will be half black and half white. And I go, no, they'll be black. The last presidential election proves anything. It's that black plus white equals black. And so the idea of like that she's not concerned about that, but then I imagine having all these, like, I want to have like four kids, and I imagine hanging out with my beautiful kids, my beautiful wife, and go, okay, kids, black people meeting, and we'll all walk out of the room together, and then we'll laugh and laugh, and I won't really have anything to say, it'll just be funny to me, and then I'll have to sleep outside.
The other thing you said in that routine that I thought was funny about that race isn't really the true obstacle at all in your relationship with your spouse. It's something else.
Race was not the – people always think that because of the show that race was the big obstacle to our marriage. Not by far. The biggest obstacle is the fact that my wife is Catholic and I am sane. So, you know, that's way bigger than
race. And now I'll really get calls.
Yeah, right. No.
Let's
from her mom.
Let's hear first from Mika in San Jose. Mika, go ahead, please. You're on the air.
Hi. I was calling from San Jose, and I wanted to say I'm black, and I don't mind if people touch my hair. As a matter of fact, I find it to be a very good conversation starter. I found myself in Burma earlier this year, and people wanted to touch my hair, like literally, like, can I please touch your hair? Of course, go ahead. So my question was, do you feel that being married to someone outside of your race has expanded your comedy in unexpected ways? And I'll take my comment off the air.
Mika, thanks.
Thanks.
Well, first of all, Mika, I want to say I think everybody can set their boundaries for where they – if they want their hair touched where they want them. And I don't think that – but I think that's the whole thing. It's your own boundary to set. Like you can't – people can't just assume. And also when I was in Japan, little Japanese women wanted to take pictures with me and I thought that was awesome. But if they want – if white women want to do that in the mission, I don't think it's awesome. Context is everything. So I get why Burma is different. But absolutely. Being not just married to a white person, married specifically to my wife – we have different ideas about race, and also we have different ideas about a lot of stuff. My wife is a pretty she's a feminist. She's a pretty radical feminist. So we have discussions about racism versus sexism and which one is at play in different scenarios. And because she actually graduated from college, unlike me, she actually has a lot of thoughts that are different than mine and much more intellectualized than mine. So when we talk about things, she's got a fully formed opinion too. So I've certainly made her see racism in places where she hasn't seen it, and she's made me see sexism and all sorts of things in places I haven't seen them. So I think it's not just a white person. You know, if I was married to a dumb white person, it wouldn't be as good.
And to Quinn in Mountain View. Quinn, go ahead, please. You're on with W. Kamau Bell.
Thank you. First, I wanted to make a comment. You had said how a lot of what the Tea Party is against the healthcare movement that was going on is because of, anti-race and because of black president. But I would say maybe more that's connected to sort of against the poor and anti-poverty and the kind of connection that those two have, and maybe race being the one that's more obvious, but really kind of, America being against the poor as being a bigger factor in that. And then also I wanted to share a personal experience. My girlfriend's black, I'm white, and we were walking around in Berkeley, and on two separate occasions we've had people yell at us, hey, you interracial couple, like trying to get us to come over so we can like answer some questions for them or whatever it is they wanted to do exactly. And I just thought it was interesting that because we were dating, that suddenly gives people an open path to just, have conversations and ask those questions.
Yeah, Quinn, thank you.
Well, yeah, I think that like that's what you find out when you're an interracial couple or when you're, and your girlfriend probably has this as a black woman that, when you're other, you often find yourself in positions where you have to answer the other questions. So, yeah, I'm sure in a interracial relationship, things like that happen all the time. And but the thing, and the thing is, and I love, there was his name Dave, was his name?
Quinn.
I love you, Quinn. And I'm sure he's a good white guy, but there's always this sort of effort sometimes from liberal white people to sort of be like, race is one thing, but actually it's class. And I sort of feel like it's both and. I think the Tea Party can be – I think the discussion in America can be about both.
On Quinn's point, though, about sort of being flagged down, hey, interracial couple, we want to ask a question. I mean, where does that fit in the continuum of can I touch your hair versus I want to have a conversation, which is part of what you want to encourage?
Well, yeah, but it's like this. If you're walking down the street and you see somebody and you go, hey, I want to have a conversation, that's not actually an appropriate, socially acceptable way to start any conversation. So and I think that's what people get confused by, too. I'm just curious. You can be curious, but you actually don't need to know the answer to the question. And unless you find yourself in a position where somebody actually invites you to express your curiosity, it becomes inappropriate.
April in San Francisco is up next. April?
Hi, it's April from San Francisco. I'm also a woman of color, and I wanted to kind of dovetail the thing about the hair. I had a horrible incident. I have two incidents. One where I was in a store, minding my own business, and my hair is in dreads with funny colors in them. And this woman from nowhere starts approaching me, and her hands out, getting ready to grab my hair. And I'm like saying, no. First she asked me, was my hair real? I said, no. She said, what do you mean it's not real? I go, no, you shouldn't be touching my hair. So I jump back, and she just starts, well, I'm sorry. I go, well, you shouldn't be touching people without their, you know, permission. And then the other thing is I become the go-to person for people who have really serious microaggression problems. So as I said, you were saying racism is not overt. Well, microaggressions are very covert. Say, for instance, I'm married to a white dude, like you're married to a white chick or woman. And people will say, well, does your mother feel that this is okay? You know, what do you guys do in your private situations? You know, all this other inappropriate stuff. And it's really all race-based. And they assume I'm the loose one and he's like the innocent one. All this other crazy stuff. So what do you think about that?
April, thanks.
Well, first of all, to share, we're having this become the hair story. I literally was walking down the street in Chicago one time and I had dreadlocks. And I suddenly felt my head being pulled from behind, and this woman had grabbed one of my dreadlocks, and I was like, and I looked at her like she was crazy. She's like, it's okay, it's my birthday, which is a classic example of like, oh, okay, I guess you can do that. No, I think that's what the covert thing is absolutely true. Most racism, you get worn down by the covert racism way more. Most black people are not going to be confronted by the Klan on their doorstep with a burning cross, you know. So the covert stuff is the stuff you deal with in a way more, the otherizing, the sort of like, I expect you to be now that we're friends, I expect you to be the repository of all my weird thoughts. And that's what I talk about. It's a spectrum. The minute you walk into a room and go, there are a lot of Indian people in here, that's racism. You know, it doesn't mean it's going to hurt those people, but it just means you're like, sort of like, why are you noticing that? Doesn't mean we all do that. But the minute you start to split people up, that's a part of racism. And then it just comes like in my show, I go, level one is like, there's a lot of Indian people in here. Level two is like, ooh, white people smell like bologna. You know, like when you start to make assumptions. Level three is, I only date this type of person, where you start to act on that thing. Doesn't mean it's bad. It just means you're splitting people up. Like, it doesn't mean it's like you're the worst person. And then level four is like acting on, like, I assume that all people are this of a certain way or this way. And then level five is the hate crime.
But going back to level one for a moment, and some of what April's talking about, when people come up and ask her certain questions that are inappropriate from her point of view. Again, I'm just interested in this question of, if part of your goal is to open up conversation, mm-hmm. get people talking about things that they might not necessarily want to talk about, mm-hmm. Doesn't that then open up April's experience or lead to that sort of situation taking place?
I would again go back to the social contract. We all know when we're in a position to have a discussion with someone. And like, if you're at my show with somebody that you came to, or you leave the show with a bunch of people and you're all at this racism show, that may be a time to sort of reach across the aisle and go, hey, person who was at the same show as I was, what did you think about that?
Yeah.
But we all know there's a social contract. If you're on a Greyhound bus at 3 a.m, right. You don't wake the person up next to you and say, I want to talk to you about your hair. And I think that we can't forget that the social contract exists on top of all this stuff. And a lot of times people hide behind, well, I'm just having the conversation. I want you to have the conversation, but also, let's enact the social contract.
Yeah. Michelle is next in San Jose. Michelle, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
So I wanted to go back to what you were saying about in different contexts, it's different. Because my husband is black and I'm white. And when we got married in L.A., it was no big deal at all. No one said anything. Moved up here, very few people give us weird looks. It's more like we're a club now. If we see other black men, white women, we're like, hey, what's up? But the worst thing I've ever gotten was in Atlanta, Georgia. And when I go to Atlanta with my husband to visit his parents, I have got to put on my game because I have been pushed. I've been called the B word. I have been, like, passed in the street and knocked. It is crazy. Those women do not like that I am married to a fine black man.
And I would say that, like, and I talk about this in my show, that, like, I will often find, and these may not be the type of people you're talking about, but there, you find that even liberal progressive black people will get upset if they find that you're in an interracial relationship. Just because there's, like, a weird, like, the woman I was talking about in my show. Like, I talk about this, like, I feel like I could tell a liberal progressive black person, like, yeah, I'm with a white person. They'll be like, huh. It better be a dude. Like, what would that make a difference? Yes. Why? I don't know. Like, a lot of this is our own inner hypocrisy. You know, like that. It's like that we can't, and we take our inner hypocrisy and we try to put it on the world and create a methodology around which it makes sense.
Michelle, thanks for the call. It's interesting. Michelle's referencing Atlanta because Atlanta is often known as a place that's a good place for African-American professionals, so forth and so
on. And gay people.
And, you know. And you've talked about the difference between Chicago and here. So it's sort of ironic in a way.
I mean, I feel like the racism show, I could have only written this show in San Francisco. Hmm. Chicago is known for being a very racist place. But in some sense, it's a little more honest and upfront with its racism. Like, there's, I don't know. I haven't lived there in over 10 years. But I felt like when I was in Chicago, like if I walked into a bar and they didn't want black people in here, they would kind of go, we don't want you in here. And you'd be like, thank you, racist people. You've made my evening much better. I can leave. You know, whereas in, I feel like I can walk into places in San Francisco and I feel like they don't want me in there, but they won't say anything. You know, like, I just feel like, how come nobody's talking? You know, so I feel like like I said, the Bay Area, as quiet as it's kept, especially, you know, although it's not that quiet all the time, there's a lot, we get a lot of the covert racism out here that really makes the show come to life.
And to Youssef, who joins us next. Youssef, go ahead.
Oh, hi, you guys. So my comment, basically, I'd like to say that, can you hear me, guys?
Yeah, go ahead.
So I just wanted to comment on something that's been said. I mean, to me, race jokes, when I go to a comedy show or when I hear, basically, I just take it as jokes. Those race jokes are merely jokes. When I go out on my life, I see a lot of racism within the black community, say, towards the Arabs or towards the Chinese. And then I see racism from Mexicans towards the black folks. And so it's really more complicated than black and white. So that's why I say comedy for me is just comedy. Reality reflects a whole different
Youssef, thanks. Your call's breaking up a little, so I'm going to let you go. But it's an interesting point you raise. And you talk about that some within your show about the sort of relationships between various ethnic and
racial. And I think we certainly, you know, and this is a sort of fault of the race discussion in America, and I'm certainly falling to this a lot. A lot of time we get focused on the black and white side of it, but the show is very aggressively, like I talk about Native Americans, I talk about the Arab debate and how Arabs on the census are white, but even though nobody thinks of Arabs as being white. So yeah, the discussion I talk is way bigger than black and white. And certainly I like to talk about the racism between the internalized racism of black people, because I'm familiar with that, and also just the racism that we as a country have against different groups. Black people in many ways are as racist against Arabs as white people are in this country. So I talk about the racism against Arabs as a whole, not like breaking it down into which group is against which. And, you know, so absolutely. I mean, I agree. As far as race jokes being race jokes, I think I feel like jokes are like a hammer. You can take the hammer and you can hammer a nail in it like you're supposed to, or you can hit somebody in the head with it. It's just like, it just depends on what you do with that hammer. And some race jokes, I think Dave Chappelle, Chris Rock, Paul Mooney, for the most part, spectacular. You know, some race jokes, Carlos Mencia, and others, you know, like he's the only one I can mention that I can think of, I don't think are helpful, you know. I think that it's all in the eye of the beholder. Enjoy who you enjoy, like who you like, but just because you think what you think doesn't mean you're right.
There's a funny bit in that I saw on one of the tapes of your shows where you're talking about the sort of census and the population breakout in this country. And you talk about the percentage of blacks, talk Pacific Islanders, so forth and so on. And then you get to Latinos and you see these numbers on a screen behind you. And the screen number when it first appears with Latinos is 14.9. And then it starts to grow as
It starts to go 14.9, 15%, 15.1, 15.2. And it's sort of a controversial joke when I do that joke because some people think I'm sort of making fun of like either Latino birth rates or making fun of Latinos is like having a lot of kids or whatever. Or the and what I'm really saying is actually, no, the Latino population in this country is growing very quickly. And I use that as an opportunity to talk about that, you know, not, and so I'm not, this is in no way a judgment about that. It's the fact that, no, as much as we, as poorly as we're treating Latinos right now, they're soon going to be 30% of the country.
Well, and it's particularly, of course, relevant to this state. And you sort of say in that routine about how you're sort of jealous of that fact because that's become the dominant minority group.
Yeah, that I feel like there's a lot of Latino pride that no matter what country you come from, as long as you speak Spanish and you're not from Spain because they still hate the oppressor, which I think is awesome, that you come to this country become part of the La Raza, whereas black people come from Africa don't necessarily become part of the black experience in this country. In fact, they sort of a lot of times they find they own – like people from Ghana found their own communities.
And to Diane in Burlingame. Diane, go ahead, please.
Hi. I'd like to make a point. The Saturday after Thanksgiving – in the editorial of the Chronicle, a woman had written a letter saying, why can't we call it anything but Black Friday? Call it Green Friday. And she went on and on and on with her little point. And I wanted to write in, but my kids say, Mama, you're just too reactionary. Mama, you'll just make a point and nobody will get it. But this woman, if I saw her on the street, she would say, I'm not racist. I don't have a racist bone in my body. And white folks always say, Black people are just too over the top with Black is beautiful, and you know, and trying to uplift their children's all this negativity about being black, and try to uplift their children's idea about being black, but they think nothing of writing a letter to the editor saying, "Call it Green Friday, not Black Friday, anything but Black Friday."
Diane, thank you.
That is funny. Diane has one of those voices that I could immediately, like, she was a black woman. It just hit me like in one of my chakras. Like, she sounds like my aunts. Like, I was just like, preach, preach, Diane, whatever you want to say, I'm on board. I was just thought she was going to be, I'm just glad she's not mad at me.
and it sounds to me like there'd be a lot of potential. I can imagine you developing something on Black
Friday.
Well,
no, I mean, I was performing on Black Friday and I was like, I talked about, welcome to the real Black Friday. You know, like, I think it should be Black Saturday, Black Sunday. I think every day should be black.
Pam in San Francisco. Go ahead, Pam.
Thank you so much. And I was just calling to comment that just think of all the comedy you have between what you have right now. And should you decide to have children, just think of all the comedy that's going to come for multi-ethnic. That's what my family is. And the only way we survive is with comedy.
Pam, thanks.
Well, no, I mean, I'm excited to we're working on children right now, so I'm excited to see what that happens.
I'm sure your wife is really glad that you just sort of had that comment to make here on public radio.
You know, she's listening, and I couldn't figure out a better way to say it. I'm sorry, honey. You know what I mean. It's not the first time I've said something made her go, "Oh, come on."
Let's hear another part of one of your routines. This is from something where you've got the surefire solution to solve California's and the nation's budget problems, and it has to do with legalizing a particular substance.
If California legalized weed, we would make $1 billion in tax revenue the first year alone. $1 billion in tax revenue. That's just the first year. That's just in California. That's not all. What if all the states legalized weed? We'd be pimping tomorrow. You know what I'm saying? That's $1 billion. And that's just on the tax revenue from weed. That doesn't even include weed-related products. Like ding-dongs, ho-hos, Twinkies, everything Hostess, new flavors of Gatorade, new colors of vitamin water, bottled water, microwave burritos, churros at carnivals and fairs, anything shiny. You know what I mean? DVDs at the grocery store that cost a dollar that you shouldn't buy, but you do because you're high.
an excerpt from the CD Face Full of Flour, which is on the top 10 list from iTunes
top
for
10.
best comedy albums of, top of 10, 2010.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt. Two different top 10 lists, Punchline Magazine and iTunes, one of the 10 best comedy CDs of 2010. And see, it's not all about race. Some of it's about marijuana.
Back to our calls. Marcus in San Francisco. Go ahead. You're on, please. Marcus, yeah. Are you with us? Go ahead.
Yeah, I sure am. Hey, I wanted to kind of bring it back to the subtle forms of racism and share an experience that happened with me. And when I was 24 years old, I was a waiter in a restaurant, and I'm mixed race. I'm Mexican-American, Mexican and Irish, actually. But a lot of times people will speak to me in Spanish when they're non-Latino. And assuming I speak Spanish automatically, even though I'm third generation and was raised speaking English only. So I was 24 years old, and this lady who was white says, you know, ¿cómo estás? And I said, I'm doing fine. And she says, you know, ¿por qué no hablas en español? You know, how come you don't speak in Spanish? And I said, well, you know, I speak English. She goes, oh, well, you speak it so well. How long have you been here? And my response to her was 24 years. And she said, how old are you? I said, 24. The look on her face was spectacular. But, you know, that's I think you touched on that, the subtle forms of racism, because it was an inherent racist statement.
Marcus, thanks.
These are the exact kind of conversations that come out of the show, and I'm glad that they're having on KQED, because this is a much bigger forum than I get. But I think that's exactly like people hearing other people who've been like him hearing that story, going, "Oh, there's somebody else who thinks that way," and then also other white people who are like, "Oh, I've done that." You know, like it, to me, it's like it just we should all have a little internal check in ourselves, especially I think in white people in America, because there's 70% of the country, to go, "Am I about to do something racist?" Because historically, my people do that quite easily. So,
and to Jeremy in Marshall this morning. Jeremy, go ahead, please. You're on.
Hi, my name's Jeremy, and I'm a racist. And I've actually been given this a lot of thought in my more mature years here, and it all stemmed, I think, from a period in my own high school experience in Marin. I was a little white, kind of Caucasian shrimp. And there were these big, fully mature black guys there from Marin City. And they used to intimidate me into giving them spare change. And I was terrified of them because I was going to get pounded if I did anything but what they told me to do. And so, and the irony now when I look back is that I'm the product of a dark German. And my mother was snuck out of Germany as a child in order to survive. And when I think back now, I wish I had had the boldness to sit down on this concrete wall next to this guy and just say, you know, I'm terrified of you, but you and I are really not that different. You got persecuted. My mother got persecuted. I'm totally fear-based. And, you know, I haven't been able to turn my fear to hatred, but I just wish now that I could have had a more mature conversation with the guy.
Jeremy,
found
thanks.
Some kind of bridge there.
Yeah, yeah. Jeremy, thank you.
You know, I mean, this is it. Like, well, hopefully, Jeremy, you have that conversation with other people in your life right now. I mean, it's the talking about it is how we end racism, not the, you know, I mean, the rallies and stuff help too, but the talking about it is really what helps bring it together.
Do you find that sort of thing happens very often, the calls like Jeremy, where that people really go pretty deep into exploring something that was not a jokey call? I mean, that was something that's deep inside.
No, I don't, especially like I'll get emails from people who will tell me stories of things like that. And now after shows, a lot of times people will tell me things that it's not, they're just sharing. It's like, it's not that there's, they think things are funny, but it's also just like, because we don't have, we're not encouraged to have those discussions unless we're angry or filing a lawsuit. So I think we very regularly, like I get emails from people wanting to, or like a conversation with people who want to just share their stories, which is an unexpected great part of the show.
Some emails coming in. Edwin writes in, I love Kamau Bell, but he's wrong about the hair thing. I'm an African-born black man. One of the most uncomfortable episodes of my life was in Butte, Montana, when everywhere I went, people stopped to stare at me. After recovering from the fear, I began to think about my childhood. I grew up in rural Kenya, and once every 5 years, a white person would wander into the village. All business would come to a standstill as men, women, and children rushed to touch the white man's skin and hair. I feel sorry for white people because they can't do that without being labeled racist.
Okay. No, again, this is all contextual. A white man in the middle of where did he say he was from? In Africa?
He's from, I guess, from Kenya.
Which Kamau's Kenyan, so I know he knows that. My name, Kamau's Kenyan. But no, I think everything's contextual, and racism is contextual, and me in Japan is different than me in San Francisco. So, you know, that's a, and I love him. We can agree to disagree.
Here's what Danielle writes in. An Oakland native who moved to Princeton, New Jersey, wrote a great novel on this subject, The Professor's Daughter. In Oakland, no one cared, but when she moved, she was often getting asked, "What are you?" Because people couldn't figure it out, being the daughter of an Irish Catholic mother and an African-American father. And that question became a pivotal part of her life as well. And so she wrote this semi-autobiographical book about it. The Professor's Daughter. You know that book?
No, I don't know that book.
All right.
No,
so thanks for the recommendation, Daniel.
I'll put it on my wish list for Amazon so somebody will get it for me.
Here's a question from Gavin. What do you think about Juan Williams being fired from NPR for his comments about Muslims?
This is one of those answering the black question. I talk about in my show that sometimes you get, and white people don't have a lot of experience with this, where something black will happen and you go to work the next day and you become the spokesperson for the race. And you know, and I feel like white people need to start doing that a lot more. White people need to actually start being the spokesperson for their race. You know, you need to start defending white people the way the rest of us have to defend our own racial groups. I actually don't even remember what I thought about that. It's one of those things. It's like when you become the black guy who's one of the go-tos for the right, you're inevitably going to find yourself in a weird position. And Juan Williams, who seems like a good dude and done a lot of good work, when you find yourself the go-to black guy for Fox News, you're inevitably going to get caught in a weird position, and that's what happened. You know, as Michael Steele for the last 2 years has been caught in a weird position because he's the go-to for the right. You know, don't be that black guy unless you're getting paid a lot of money.
What are you going to work on next? What's ahead for you in 2011?
In 2011, I'm taking my show. I mean, it looks like I'm going to take my show to a bunch of colleges, which I'm really excited about. I just did a Skyline College in San Bruno recently, which was one of the greatest shows I've ever done. Because I think that really makes the show pop in a different way when college kids see it. And because they're experiencing it on a different level. They're in classes talking about it and then to see it. So I'm really enjoying doing that. And I'm actually working on there's sort of preliminary talks, as they're always preliminary, on sort of a TV show version of the show. So I'm working with I have an agent and a couple managers that have scooped me up and hope to do that and take the show into the next place. You know, I'd love to do it at the Berkeley Rep. Are you out there, Berkeley Rep? But and also hopefully working on new CDs that I can be on another top 10 list. But Face Full of Flower, perfect for the holidays. Check out my website.
W.A. Kamau Bell, our guest. He appears at the Cheapest Greatest New Year's Eve comedy show at the Phoenix Theater in San Francisco on both December the 30th and the 31st. Really a pleasure to have you on our program this morning. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I hope people come to the show and just check me out online at my website, goodshownegro.com.
And we also want to let you know about a new initiative here at KQED before we close out. If there's a story that you think Forum or KQED News should cover, you can tell us about it by joining the Public Insight Network and help inform KQED reporters and editors. You can sign up for that at kqednews.org/publicinsight. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Danny Bringer is our engineer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.